Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe. I'd like now to welcome back to the show Merle Lefkoff. She's the president of Ars Publica, which is an international non-governmental organization based here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be back.
It's good to have you back. Now, you were recently in New York observing and talking to people in Occupy Wall Street, and you're the first person I've had on the air talking about this subject. What did you see when you were there?
Well, it was just last week, actually, so it's pretty current. What was interesting for me is seeing, and this is what I was looking for, what was going on that I thought might be significant that hasn't been reported very much in the mainstream press, because there's a lot going on that I think people, number one, don't quite understand or can't quite get their arms around yet. And there's also some very interesting stuff that just kind of goes on behind the scenes.
One thing that's so interesting about this moment, and that's interesting about being in a kind of a social movement in progress, or really at its beginning, is that everybody tries to map it onto things that they already know. And so there are ways in which maybe it's like, I mean, you hear people saying, oh, those hippies, you know, sort of naysayers. But they're not those hippies from the 1960s. It's a different time. It's a different movement.
Exactly. It's very, very different. I mean, there are some similarities in all social movements. But as you said very insightfully, this is such a different time. This is a time when we have different media at our disposal, which was one of the biggest differences. It's one reason that these social movements can spread so quickly. And that alone is very different from, for example, the social movements in the 60s. Very, very different.
Another difference is just the economics of that time and this time. I mean, it's very rough for so many people. I mean, they call themselves the 99%. It's, I think, much harder than it was. It seems like there was just a lot more money, cheap land, jobs, and food and things like that available in the late 60s.
We weren't having the deep recession that we're having now, but those movements were as much about social justice and ending the war in Vietnam. The civil rights movement, of course, was a social justice movement. And the people who were part of that movement, for the most part, were not elites, not privileged. And also, although they didn't talk about it very much, it wasn't their program. Their program was a civil rights program. They were certainly part of the 99%, we would say now.
Right.
Even though that wasn't the target of the movement itself.
So you go to New York, you get off the plane, you go down to, well, what neighborhood did you spend time in?
Well, I went down to the main site. The main site is at Broadway and Liberty, pretty near Ground Zero, so in Lower Manhattan. So I went directly to the Occupy Wall Street site. It was pretty interesting, Mary Charlotte.
What did you see?
Well, one of the things that I was curious about was the neighborhood around there. It isn't exactly on Wall Street. It's not quite at Wall Street. But it is in a very dense Manhattan neighborhood. And I was told that it's a neighborhood of 64,000 people. So
that was... What, the entire city of Santa Fe?
I know, isn't that interesting? That's the little neighborhood where Occupy Wall Street is. And they're very sensitive to the neighbors. If you remember early on, people were worried about the trash and the garbage and the waste and the, oh my goodness, in the middle of Lower Manhattan. But they have a very good relationship with the neighbors, and they have what's called their official good neighbor policy, and it is posted all around the site. And it explains the rules for being a good neighbor with the 64,000 people who live immediately around them.
What are some of those rules?
There's a zero tolerance for drugs and alcohol. You can probably guess what they are. No violence, no verbal abuse.
So you don't have the smell of pot wafting through the air?
No, you don't.
So that's another difference from the 60s.
That's a big difference from the 60s. So they're very careful about that. They don't want to hear either verbal or verbal abuse. They don't want to see physical abuse of any kind. There's a lot of drumming going on. And they even have a rule about the drumming that has to do with the neighbors again, the good neighbor policy. You're only allowed to drum 2 hours a day between certain hours, not after 5 o'clock. I mean, it's a little city with its own good neighbor policies all set up. I thought that was pretty interesting. And they have a community relations person who's designated to make sure the rules are followed. And it's very it's not intrusive at all. These people who have this special designation just make sure that things stay mellow. And they're kind of like ombudsmen.
So it's basically, in some ways, a creation of a kind of neighborhood you'd want to have anywhere that you live.
Absolutely. It looks a little strange because it's got lots of tents and sleeping bags. Now, it was warm when I was there last week, and I'm sure it's gotten colder since then. It was still warm, and so there's a big kitchen to make sure everybody gets fed. There's a medical tent operated by Occupy Wall Street nurses. It is honestly like a little city, and it's pretty mellow.
Could you get a sense of how many people were actually camped there?
People were coming in and out all the time. I could guess there were. As a permanent, I mean, I spent a lot of time there for a day and a half. I'd say there were at least, my goodness, 500 people or more, maybe 500 to 1,000 people living there in tents every day, sleeping there.
What was the demographics, more or less? I mean, young people, old people, black, white, everybody?
I would say mostly young. And for me, mostly young means under 40. They were well educated. I talked to a lot of the people who were, you know, there on a regular basis. One of the interesting things is so many of them had laptops going all the time. I mean, this is what this is about. It's about being online, being connected, completely connected, everywhere in the country and all over the world, all the time.
So the Occupy Wall Street are talking to the Occupy Washington and Boston and Oakland and perhaps Santa Fe,
right,
and so on.
So people who think that this is complete chaos, there's no order here, where are the demands, as you mentioned at the beginning, have no conception about how emergent all of the structures and the orderliness of it is.
Well, you study, and your organization, Ars Publica, is dedicated to transforming the whole process of peace building and diplomacy through studying and understanding complexity science. That deserves some explanation, but it's relevant to this whole question of what's going on Occupy Wall Street and Occupy all these other cities.
Right. And I think this is an example. I was so excited when this took off. I started watching this before Occupy Wall Street when, I don't know if you remember Mary Charlotte, Uncut UK. Do you remember that?
Mm-mm.
They were already organizing in Great Britain. And we were hearing about it on the web. And I thought, wow, this looks like something important. And then, of course, it morphed here into Occupy Wall Street. But it was already happening, and I thought, I got so excited. I said, these are the principles of complex system science being played out as a case study for us, right in front of us. And it's going to be difficult for people to understand why it doesn't seem to have the presence that, for example, the civil rights movement had, or the feminist movement had, because those were very, very focused on a particular goal. very focused, and leaders emerged that everybody could identify with because they were singular leaders in a leadership position. In a complex system, which is what I think so different about this, I mean, Occupy Wall Street is a big complex system. What's interesting about it is, number one, it's self-organizing, very adaptive. It's changing every day. And we know in complex systems science research that this self-organization leads to what are called leaderless systems, because it allows leadership to emerge all through the system for whatever task is needed.
Let's just talk for a moment about other kinds of complex systems that emerge in similar ways and that adapt in similar ways that are perhaps found in nature, just so people can make an analogy.
Of course. Thank you for reminding us of that. I mean, this, what we study are complex social systems, but we're embedded in nature too. We've sort of been separated academically for a very long time. But complex system science includes looking at the dynamics of social systems, which and where the rules that are the rules that apply and what emerges is the same thing that emerges in ecological and natural systems.
So flocks of birds, schools of fish,
beehives, plant communities that do much better in polycultures rather than just planting, for example, one seed and one kind of plant.
Because they basically each, you have some plants that fertilize the soil and other plants that take up those nutrients and some that shade the lower plants and some like sun and so on.
And you can't predict. These are what mathematicians call nonlinear systems. In other words, what goes in is not necessarily what comes out, because something new is always emerging. That's the adaptation part. And so if you can't predict what's going to come out, the more diversity there is, the more interaction there is, the more dynamical and adaptive the system is, the more exciting it is, and the more chance of success if you look at it from a natural systems ecological standpoint. So Occupy Wall Street is like a big field of biennials and polycultures. That's
right.
What it's like.
It's very interesting. I mean, I have definitely noticed when just even tending to a garden, the analogies to human social systems, you know, the weeds that are so tenacious and the things that you have to cultivate so hard in order to even to make them work at all and so
right.
on. And we have talked on this show in the context of ecosystems how when you have a complex ecosystem and you remove one species and then another and another, and at a certain point the whole system breaks down. Mm-hmm. And likewise, when you have a human community that is very diverse with a lot of skill sets and a lot of different kinds of people, they're more likely to be successful.
They are, and we have research that, I mean, I don't know why people don't understand this, because the research is so clear about this in human systems as well as in natural systems, that's absolutely one of the key. That what they call in complexity science requisite variety is essential. So that's another thing about this particular movement. You can't pinpoint, well, there's a group of college students who are worried because they can't pay off their student loans, and that's what this is about. Or here's a group of people who have lost their jobs, and joblessness is what it's about. And this, you can't, all of this is mixed up. And out of this, because this is one of the things that happens, will be something new that's unpredictable, hopefully something new, if it isn't pushed into coming out with demands too quickly. This is a mistake.
Yeah, as Avi Lewis said the other night at the Lenzic in the Lannan presentation when he was talking to Tariq Ali, the demand for demands.
The demand for demands, right. And this is inappropriate in this particular kind of a system. Let it emerge on its own. Otherwise, if you push the demands too quickly, the same old thing is going to happen. And this is something to watch in the Arab Spring as well. Because in the Arab Spring, as they're searching for democracy in some way, searching for their version of social justice, with no democratic history. Immediately, people think elections are the answer, and that's the first thing you do. And if you do that too quickly before the emergence of new political parties that come out of the revolutions themselves with candidates that have some way of standing for office, then you get the same guys back in again in a different form. And
history has shown us that over and over again.
And so so that's one of the things that I think it has to be nurtured in such a way that people aren't forcing those demands, I think, is very important.
We're talking to Merle Lefkoff about Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy movements. Now, one of the things that I find fascinating that's coming out of these movements is the storytelling aspect. This seems to be a place where people are telling their stories. And again, it's no one story. It's kind of the overall mosaic that is made by the individual stories that is the big story.
And you know how the stories are being told. They're being told in their signage. Now, I was determined that I was going to take pictures with my cell phone, take pictures of people and what they were doing. And I came home and I realized I had 50 pictures of signs because they were so compelling.
What are some of your favorites?
My very favorite one, I can't remember it exactly, but there was a gentleman, he was probably in his 60s, he had a little beard, and he had the sign, a big sign around his neck, and it says, "I am here because I am searching for a gentle world." And gentle was in big letters. This is a home that can offer a more gentle world. And I just stood there and looked at that sign, you know. And if you remember, Tariq Ali the other night said his favorite sign was, "We're here, we're unclear, get used to it."
Yeah. Which supports what you're saying about if you want leadership, if you want new ways of thinking to emerge, let them emerge. I mean, I sort of think of the analogy of, if you want a nice apple, let it ripen. Don't take the little hard thing off of the tree.
That's right. That's very good. That's very good. You know, this one of the signs I just remembered said, "We're an otherwise unaffiliated group." That's what it said. "We're an otherwise unaffiliated group." I loved that because that also, right? Doesn't that also express this idea of this completely open space?
And it's also, I mean, I love those signs too because they're such an expression of people's sense of humor.
Right, right. And there's lots of that there. There's lots of that. Some of them are quite serious and some of them are very, very funny, but absolutely to the point.
I think the fact that it is young people there primarily, although we certainly see people of all ages, one of the things I see is people who don't have a lot of hope for personal success or for a coherent social system given the various structures that we are living in now, which have become so top-heavy economically and so privatized and corporatized ideologically.
I'm so glad you said that because this is the thing, I guess, looking at it from outside as opposed to inside, and I hope everybody is joining the march in Occupy Santa Fe. This is one of the things I'm a little worried about. I have been back and forth on email since I got back with a professor named Bill Dumhoff at University of California in Santa Cruz. And he, a decade ago, just about predicted exactly what was getting ready to happen because of what was happening in America, and he predicted it quite early. And he is a theoretician of social movements and a researcher in social movements. And he has very compelling research that suggests that the most successful social movements have had an electoral strategy.
Now, that's very interesting because, in a way, if you say, okay, this is a social movement, we need to move toward an electoral strategy, that's sort of the opposite of the
gradual emergence idea. That's absolutely right. But strategy is beginning to emerge. And that's one of the things I was looking for at Occupy Wall Street. There are these thematic working groups that are meeting all the time. And I think what Professor Dumhoff, what Bill Dumhoff would say is, hopefully, some of those thematic working groups that are spontaneously emerging to talk about different issues, that at least a couple of them will be talking about, okay, what does this mean about changing, for example, the Democratic Party. I'm not even going to address the Republican Party. Changing the Democratic Party. How does this move the progressive political movement forward? That some thematic group will begin at least to talk about that. And he is very precise about what could happen with that kind of approach. At the same time, again, you don't want to push it, but we've got an election a year away. And he has some very strategic ideas about how that might work.
Can you say more about that?
Yes. He really believes that, and he talks about the Democratic Party. By the way, his website, Mary Charlotte, is called Who Rules America?
Right.
And I want to make sure that I'm not just speaking for him. People can go directly to his website. He says basically there's two things in a movement that have historically made them successful and are probably still viable in today's movements. One is strategic nonviolence, and we haven't talked about that at all. And the second thing is an electoral strategy. What he suggests in an electoral strategy is that that Occupy Wall Street, say, if it had a working group or thematic group on this issue, would be promoting, would be recruiting and promoting candidates to run all over the country in the next election
at every level.
At every level, but mostly he's talking about the congressional level. He's talking at about a high level of getting into positions of power that can make change, getting people into positions of power who aren't there now. And moving the debate and moving the dialogue, the political dialogue, which is so center right now, which is what's making progressives crazy, as we know. So to run for those seats that are open seats, open Democratic seats, because Democrats have left for one reason or another, and to go ahead and put them in the primaries, put these candidates in the primaries, and then in those districts also, which I think is quite interesting, where the Democratic Party, the Democratic National Committee, has given up because there's such strong Republican districts, go ahead and run.
Yeah.
Run these candidates in those districts.
I think one of the things that I find kind of irritating is, first of all, the idea that there's this spectrum from left to right. It's a very linear way of thinking. And if you actually start talking to people, their political ideas are so multidimensional. But also that this center, this quote-unquote center, really represents a kind of moderate, you know, I use that word in quotations, idea about anything. I mean, what I see these Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Every Place folks talking about are basic moral issues, basic issues of fairness, of justice, of having a clean environment, of having a future for your children and grandchildren, not to mention yourself, of having a fair economic structure in which, you know, you put in and you get something out. I mean, those are so basic. And the idea that these should be sort of shunted off to some kind of progressive ideology, those things to me seem like as dead center as you can possibly get.
You're using all the right terms. And Dumhoff talks about that too. He suggests that every social movement has a larger values, moral values context, which is exactly what you're saying, Mary Charlotte. And he said what's interesting, what he's written recently, what's interesting about this one is that it is such a basic message this time. It's very basic that it is so all-inclusive because it is about freedom and democracy. That is that large, moderate center that that you've just been describing. And he honestly sees this this time as one where these social movements have that center value system. I think what he also suggests, though, is it's moved, the center has moved so far right electorally and politically that that's why there needs to be some recovery.
But even that, I mean, what is the meaning of that? The center has moved so far right.
It's very linear. It's very linear thinking.
But what it really means is that the people with the most money are setting the rules of the game, mm-hmm. and that everybody else suffers. And that it doesn't even have to do with ideology about issues. That's just like, we want all the money, and therefore you don't get to have environmental regulation, for example.
Yeah. Well, it is about the issue of where democracy and capitalism intersect. And there's a lot of confusion out there about the difference between democracy and capitalism.
Yes. Let's talk about that for a moment. Okay. I remember that came up in the 1980s. The democracy, capitalism, and freedom were sort of conflated, and mm-hmm. they're such different concepts.
They really are different concepts. And it doesn't mean... It doesn't mean you can't have a democratic capitalist system that works. And this gets back to the idea that this isn't left, right, linear. We're talking about what works, what doesn't work. You could have a capitalist democracy. I mean, capitalism is about money flowing. I mean, that's basically what it's a system of money that flows.
Well, it's basically having a chunk of money that you put into something, starting a business of some kind and trading.
Yeah, and money now, because it's connected globally, is flowing all over the world. That doesn't have to have anything moral or immoral or amoral put to it. But what has happened to capitalism is what the problem is. And democratic capitalism, the way it's being practiced now, I think most people would say, has failed, and it's failed globally.
How would you characterize those failures? And also, let's talk about what its successes are.
Here's one of its successes, and here's something that I think a lot of people don't know either. And I'm, as you know, a recovering international mediator. The world is more peaceful now than it has ever been in human history.
Believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen.
Believe it or not.
That is hard to believe.
It is hard to believe. There's a new... Steven Pinker is the philosopher guy behind this. And he has a new book out. I'm trying to remember the name of Pinker's book. But Pinker's new book is page after page of research on what has happened to humankind in the last 10,000 years, even with our carbon load, even with our huge population growth, that we are still more peaceful and better off than we have ever been before on a global level. Now, obviously, in some places that's not true, certainly not true in sub-Saharan Africa, because of what's happening environmentally.
And it's not true in super poor communities here in the United States.
It's not, but overall, the United States is more peaceful. And then, believe it or not, even with the wars in Afghanistan, it seems like it's endless war for us.
Yeah.
But he has page after page of statistics and analysis. It's fascinating. And the reason for that is the advance of science and the advances that that has brought to everything from healthcare to infant mortality, to feeding the world, although that's disappearing now too.
Yeah.
It's a very uplifting message, I guess. But it's not. It's in process. It's not a final message yet, obviously, mainly because of global climate change.
So, what I hear you saying is some of the conditions for peace include healthcare, education, absolutely, and a good food supply.
Good food supply.
And when you have those things, you're more likely to be peaceful.
And there's one other thing that may be the most important variable of all, which is the advancement of women. Now, women certainly haven't advanced, we think of, more than a micro fraction.
Right.
But that's not true. And in much of the world, there has been advances for women, and that has made a huge difference. And very honestly, I have certainly come to believe, I think a lot of people have, that that's the key element that we need to get out of all the bad stuff we're in now that holds us back. So we should all be putting people in. We should be putting just women into those electoral positions. Let women be the ones who have positional power. You know, this nonsense about, well, we're in the background, we do all the volunteer work, and women do start NGOs all over the world, while the men are still being the ones who are elected to positional power.
We're talking to Merle Lefkoff. She's the president of Ars Publica, a non-governmental organization that's based here in Santa Fe, talking about Occupy Wall Street. Now, you were talking about the importance of the position of women, and I just heard a radio broadcast very recently about how when smart young women and men who seem like they're going to be future leaders are questioned, the men are more likely to consider running for elected office, whereas the women are more likely to consider starting nonprofit organizations, just what you were saying.
That's right.
What did you see, I mean, in terms of emergent leadership, in terms of the voices being heard from Occupy Wall Street, is there equality? Is there gender equality there?
No. As one would probably predict in this instance, most of the voices are male voices. Now, what's it, for people who might be interested in this, Code Pink, one of our favorite feminist organizations, it's a peace-building organization is how it started. Code Pink is watching this very carefully, and they have had some questions about Occupy Wall Street from the beginning, because as they wrote in their emails, we take words and language very seriously. And the word occupy to them was a red flag, because they're devoted to ending the occupations that are currently underway,
right,
all over the world.
Right, right.
So that even that language alone alerted them to pay attention to this as a feminist group. And they are very much in favor. In fact, Code Pink is at all the demonstrations. They are in solidarity with these demonstrations. At the same time, I think they really are the voice of conscience in making sure that we get very direct about how important it is, once again, a unique historical opportunity to pay attention to putting women forward, putting women's voices forward, and promoting women in this movement and in everything that happens next.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that Code Pink is kind of an older group and the Occupy Wall Street is kind of a younger group. And I think a lot of women mature into leadership a little bit later in life. I don't know if that's true.
Code Pink, I think, you know, I don't know the demographics of Code Pink, but my guess is that their demographic is pretty much young people, middle-aged people. I'd guess their demographic is maybe 20 to 50. Honestly, I think there are a lot of young people in Code Pink because they do direct action. And it's mostly young people who do direct action. One of the things we love about Occupy Wall Street is we've got people of all ages. One of the pictures I did take was a picture of three ladies clearly in their late 70s, maybe 80s. They all had signs on, Grannies for Occupying Wall Street. I did take a picture of them. And there were a lot of older people there as well. So I think Code Pink, I think of Code Pink because they do so much direct action that I think of them primarily as a pretty young group.
So when you have, you've got a lot of more male voices representing this movement in the media, but what do you have? I mean, there are working groups that are emerging and that are coalescing in Occupy Wall Street? What are they talking about? What are they working on? What do they look like?
Well, they look like, to me right now, they look like kind of, I haven't seen anything new yet in the working groups. There's an environmental working group. There's a sustainability working group. One of the more interesting working groups that I visited with for a little while, and it was a guy who was a professor in the New York area, was very interested as quickly as possible in getting curriculum built around this new kind of social movement to immediately put into the curricula all over the higher education in New York. And he just walked in and said, let's have a higher education curriculum working group. And people were coming
to
that.
That's so interesting.
And I thought that was one of the more interesting things, because he wanted to do it quickly, and with the new social media now and with the tools we have, he could do it pretty quickly. He was already soliciting people to come and talk to his classes. He was a political scientist.
How does this movement, in your view, compare, I don't even know if you want to go here, but to the Tea Party, which is also, I mean, everyone says it's totally funded by the Koch brothers. That's not true. It has a very strong grassroots element to it.
It does have I saw the Tea Party as very similar in terms of being a new social system that was emerging, a new complex system that was emerging. What happened there, however, I think what makes it truly different is it was taken over pretty quickly by an elite leadership cadre that did not allow it to perhaps manifest in a different way. It might have been able to reform the Republican Party on there in that way, as I keep looking for this to reform the Democratic Party, because our system does not allow for third parties, and that's been made clear all through our history, although there are still people who cling to that.
You were saying before that the two really important movements that need to happen for a group to be successful is strategic nonviolence and having an electoral strategy.
Well, this is what Dumhoff has shown over and over again. And we've seen that. We've seen that, and we've seen how difficult it is to keep these movements nonviolent. But I think it's definitely working here. The police community relations. Even the police, some of them are not as well trained as they might be in crowd control. But even the police are different today, and most of them have had a lot of training in how you address these kinds of movements. I lived through the civil rights movement in the South. I raised my family in Atlanta, and I was actually teaching at Morehouse College to get myself through graduate school, and that was Martin Luther King's alma mater. So I was in the middle of the civil rights movement. That's a black men's school. And I will tell you, they had to be so courageous, so brave, because wherever they went, on the buses, sitting at the lunch counters, marching down the streets, they were beaten up, severely, severely beaten up, hauled off to jail, and they kept coming back, and they never struck back. They had constant training in nonviolence. And I didn't see a lot of that going on at Occupy Wall Street, but that might be because the times are different now. And there's almost an intuitive sense how important it is to keep it nonviolent on both the police side and the community side.
There was some kind of instigator in Occupy Washington, D.C., who turned out to be a planted, right. What do you call those people?
Well, somebody subversively who's put into the
he wasn't actually part of the movement. Trying to destroy the movement.
They're very conscious of this. Remember I said earlier that they have these people walking around who are kind of like ombudsmen, and they've been given that temporary authority to make sure that things stay mellow, and they are always watching for people like that. But in addition to that, particularly in New York, because there's huge food kitchens and they're serving food, people are just walking in off the streets who honestly are just looking for a meal. I met some of those people. And some of those people are mentally disturbed and can cause problems and a disturbance. They're very gentle and mellow and watching for that kind of thing all the time. And they're going to get more and more sophisticated about it, I think.
Right. We're talking to Merle Lefkoff about Occupy Wall Street. So, do you have any sense of where this is going to go when the weather gets cold?
I think it's going to be harder for people to stay. But I honestly believe that the stalwarts will continue to figure out how to stay warm. They're very closely packed, Mary Charlotte. I'm sure there's some very
good... keeping each other warm.
They are literally, in some much of the space there, keeping each other warm. They absolutely are. And I think they're going to figure that out. I mean, this isn't Alaska, although Alaska's getting warmer. This isn't Alaska. And I think they're going to figure it out. And, you know, lots of them go home at night, come back first thing in the morning to refresh. And but it's truly amazing. You know, something else I didn't mention is there's kind of a cordon around the space itself. And people are kind of all lined up outside, and the police keep them moving. They don't want them just standing there and looking. And more often than not, I was watching during lunch hour, particularly, people who work on Wall Street coming in to talk to the occupied Wall Street. And I listened in on some of those conversations and kind of inserted myself once in a while and asked some questions. And those were some of the most interesting conversations.
What were they saying?
Because the Wall Street people were truly trying to they couldn't understand what this was about. That's what was so funny for me. Well, but why are you here? What's your program? You know, tell me what I'm doing wrong. I go to work every day. I mean, they were very defensive, asking, you know, why are you here? Why are you doing this?
Yeah, like,
because
what,
I don't get it.
What I do.
What yeah,
I do
what
wrong.
I do. Exactly. Very good. And those were some of the most interesting conversations. But even those conversations were very civil, very
and
respectful.
Were the occupiers able to explain it in a way that these people could understand?
Oh, I thought they were brilliant. I absolutely thought they were brilliant.
You see the light bulb go off in the head of any of these Wall Street
people? Not very often. Not very often. But they were only there for their lunch hour. But they were brilliant. They would say things like, "We want to restore democracy in America, and it's out of whack." And they would gently say, "Do you have a sense of how unequal the pot is right now?" And the Wall Streeters would always say, "Yes, we do. But we worked hard to do." I mean, this is, I don't have to tell you, this is always the answer. This is the land of opportunity. We worked hard to get where we are. They do not see that it isn't equal opportunity at
right.
the bottom. That's the part they miss.
And that in order for them to become as wealthy as they are, somebody's got to be working for slave wages or for low wages.
Right. Or they've inherited the money, or the elite class has passed down. I mean, this is not democratic anymore. This is not how it works anymore.
I think one of the fundamental problems that we have is that politics is corrupted by money, that you need to be a gazillionaire to run a Senate campaign, to run a presidential campaign, to even a congressional campaign costs a huge amount of money, and a lot of that goes into TV ads, and TV ads seem to be a kind of make or break decision maker for so many people who vote, which seems insane. And so both reforming the money in politics question and getting people to be more media savvy so that they don't make decisions based on television commercials. I keep going back to those things.
In order to have a media savvy population, we need a better educated population. And so it's all connected. It's absolutely all connected, but you've brought up perhaps one of the most important points in all that is almost the basis of these social movements, which is, what do you do about money in politics? Because that's part of the reason, it's a large part of the reason why Wall Street has gotten away with what it's gotten away with, because it's not regulated. And it's not regulated because politicians are bought and sold. And that's just the bottom line. It isn't even a question of buying media ads. Everybody should read the November 10th issue, which is coming out soon, of Rolling Stone, read about Rick Perry in Texas and read what has happened to the state of Texas. So that's just one case study. One case study in what has happened to America. We all know now, because we've heard about it, that Obama has to raise $1 billion in his race for the presidency. Now, that's not how he got elected last time.
Although he did have significant Wall Street support last time.
And look at what has happened.
Now, do you find an ethos of disappointment with Obama at Occupy Wall Street?
Most of those people didn't even want to talk about Obama. They just didn't want to engage it at all. Because right now where they are, and I said earlier, this is the one thing that I'm a little concerned about, is they're so completely outside the system. They see themselves as part of the values context and the values package. We are outside this system. We want to restore the democratic process, and we're going to do it outside the system. We're not sure how we're going to do it yet. That hasn't emerged yet, but we know something has to happen. So it's difficult to talk to them even about how you feel about going inside the system to make change, because they're so outside it now, which is where they should be, I think, at this point.
So we have a system that is fundamentally corrupted by money, and that's exacerbated by extreme inequality, so that money is in the hands of very few. What do you do?
Well, Occupy Wall Street says, forget this system. We're completely outside the system now. We are going to say that this doesn't work, and hopefully what will emerge is a new system that might work better. It's possible that this system could work. We have a democratic system. We have capitalism. If we could take the violence and destruction out of the democratic system and out of the capitalist system, maybe that system could work better. And maybe that's the intersection between going outside and also working on the inside with an electoral strategy which doesn't include too much money.
Because when you say, you know, the whole system needs to be brought down, I mean, we do have kind of a good constitution, and we do have an incredibly sophisticated set of infrastructures which bring us products that make us more comfortable and ways of communicating with each other and all kinds of things that are not inherently bad and to be thrown out. And nobody wants to go back to making their own, very few people, making their own clothes out of the wool that they shear from sheep or whatever. And so it does seem like taking the good things about the system that we're living in, both in terms of capitalism and in terms of our democratic structures, is not the worst idea.
Exactly. We are still the country in the world that most of the people in the world would love to live in. We know that. We know that. Everybody wants to come here. They copy our culture all over the world. This is a great country.
On that note, shall we close?
Let's close. But let's also celebrate Occupy Wall Street. That's going to make this country great again.
Merle Lefkoff is president of Ars Publica, which is an international non-governmental organization based in Santa Fe that is seeking to transform peace building and diplomacy through the understanding of complexity science. And let's have you back again soon.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.